The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the eighth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Habitat for God and Man, given in Eugene, Oregon, May 18th, 2024.
In this series now that I've been covering on a habitat for God and man, we're talking about dwelling places. The Bible talks more about dwelling places, although it does talk about habitation, so all of those are part of the connected concept. And we're emphasizing this aspect of those requirements that we have as human beings in order to live and to survive, let alone to thrive. As God created and made available to us, and all of these things then physically have their spiritual counterpart. So the intent has been to try to show a little bit more depth concerning the role of these physical things as God made them and how they relate to understanding things about His spiritual realm and His work with us. So we've analyzed the fact that obviously we are very vulnerable beings physically. We need a lot of support in order to stay alive. You know, unlike certain other creatures that God made on this earth who kind of carry everything they need with them, we're not so hardy. And so God made us vulnerable physically. And we need things like air to breathe, and we need water to drink, and we need clothes, and we need food, and we need shelter. And so we've talked about each one of those things in particular. We've contrasted our vulnerability physically, the temporal nature of our physical existence, with that of God, who is eternal. He doesn't need a house to live in. He is the one who created everything that exists in heaven and earth. And so as he told David, you know, the earth is my footstool, and what house are you going to build for me? So it's a huge contrast between the God realm and the human realm. So up to now, we've analyzed more, I'm going to say, from the standpoint of human beings, us in particular, and the things we need to live. Now, God could provide all of that in a little bubble. You know, you and I could each kind of have our little habitat. It's like a little room, a tiny home or something. And we have our air and our water and we have our food and we have our shelter and we have our clothes, and we could live in this little bitty box and have all of those things. But God actually gave us this incredible planet to live on and the ability to move and to go. And some of you who like to travel, you take advantage of that, and you enjoy the beauty of the creation that God made and the variety upon this planet. And in every part of the world, which has its unique aspects to that creation. So you get to roam anywhere you want, if you can and if you desire to, and enjoy quite an abundance physically upon this particular orb called the Earth. So up to now, we've only talked about the requirements of human beings, a habitat, if you will, an environment like a fish in an aquarium, and the things that we need just to keep ourselves alive. But today I want to expand this out. And my goal is going to be to get you to think about the Earth in relationship to the solar system and the rest of the universe, and what a unique and absolutely unique environment this is. So yes, it's going to be another one of those that has a lot of science in it. And I'm going to give you the spiritual interludes with the statements that God made in the Bible to try to harness the concept scientifically into that as God describes it. My goal will be, if I can do it correctly, is to leave you with a greater appreciation for this earth that you live on. Because it's easy to take it for granted. It's easy to take for granted that the sun's going to come up the next morning, whether you can see it through the clouds in Oregon or not, or wherever you are on the earth, or, you know, whatever. But we take so much for granted. The constancy of our physical environment upon this earth. And it's very, very easy to take it for granted. But what I want to try and impart to you with going through some of the science that which makes the earth absolutely unique, as far as we know in the universe, is how absolutely vulnerable we are. How vulnerable is this environment in this place in the universe? How absolutely singular it is, because there's nothing like it. There's certainly nothing like it that human beings have ever been able to detect thus far. So we're analyzing aspects of God's incredible creation. And today then we want to consider what makes this earth unique in the universe as a place that man can live and thrive. So what makes this earth different than all other planets in this solar system? And what can we learn about God's plan from what he says is going to happen in the future? I'm going to have a little bit of prophecy in this sermon for those of you who like prophecy. Because when we get to it, there's a lot of things God has to say prophetically about events when he starts to move things around in the heavens, which is going to really upset the standard of the way things exist and operate right now. So let's start by noting that the Earth is considered by scientists to be a habitable planet. And you already know that because you live on it. But let me give you a couple of citations. One, I'm going to start from the NASA website. Here's a small paragraph. It says from a NASA website, what makes a planet habitable? So when a scientist speaks about a habitat or something that is habitable by human beings, what do they mean? Okay, they say whether a planet is habitable or can host life, that's what they mean, can it host life, depends on a complex network of interactions among the planet, other planets in its own solar system, and the star that they orbit. Did you even know that the Earth depends not just on the sun, but on other planets? I'm going to show you a couple of things. You may not have known that. It's not just about the Earth's relationship to the sun, because the movement of other planets in our solar system impacts your habitat upon this Earth. We're going to look at that. They say the standard definition for a habitable planet is one that can sustain life for a significant period. Based on our own solar system, life, they say, requires liquid water. Now, you already knew we've talked about water, but it's from a scientific standpoint, they consider this a key element. Liquid, not just water, but liquid water, energy, and nutrients. Those three things. Liquid water, energy, and nutrients. A habitable zone, quote unquote, is the region around a star where planets can receive the perfect amount of heat to maintain liquid water on their surfaces. Because Earth is in the habitable zone of the sun, this arrangement has informed our understanding of habitability. Okay, that's the way they phrase it. So the Earth, they consider, is a habitable planet because it actually has liquid water and the right amount of heat from our star, i.e. the sun. Okay, we're going to expand on some of this with some other citations, but here's a fairly short one from the American Museum of Natural History. I was trying to pull out synoptic statements which kind of set the stage for how they view everything that ultimately makes this Earth so unique. American Museum of Natural History website says, a special planet, the habitable Earth. They say, what makes the Earth habitable? It is the right distance from the sun. It is protected from harmful solar radiation by its magnetic field. You're probably somewhat aware of that. We're going to expand on that. Protected from harmful solar radiation by its magnetic field. It is kept warm by an insulating atmosphere. And it has the right chemical ingredients for life, including water and carbon. The processes that shape the Earth and its environment constantly cycle elements through the planet. That may be an element that's confusing and maybe you didn't think about. It's the processes that shape the Earth and its environment constantly cycle elements through the planet. This cycling sustains life and leads to the formation of the mineral and energy resources that are the foundation of modern technological society. And I'm assuming by that that they're talking about rare earth minerals that are being mined right now in order to produce computers and chips and battery elements and all of these things which are so important to, well, and you know, if you read somewhat about the scarcity, that's why they're called rare earth minerals. And a lot of them, by the way, are in China. So great concern about certain countries having a corner on the market for some of these things that all nations around the earth now in this modern society depend upon, although I think there have been some new deposits found in the USA on certain of these rare earth minerals. But anyway, so this citation is talking about the actual movement and a lot of the interplay within the earth, which exchanges and move things in and out of the crust, which actually provides a lot of useful minerals that human beings use. And so those are things you wouldn't think about when you're talking about what makes a planet where human beings can live, but it is one of the benefits that we actually have upon this particular planet. All right, here's another quote from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Now they do a lot of science and they have telescopes and they make a lot of key elements for NASA and in different projects concerning space. But here, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory from their website says, NASA's Kepler mission, and we're talking about basically a big telescope observatory program. NASA's Kepler mission is helping in the quest for Goldilocks planets. Now I've got a few other citations that talk about Goldilocks planets. What are we talking about? They say where conditions are just right, quote unquote, for development of life. And so if you know the fairy tale of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, by the way, I would say Goldilocks, one, she was a housebreaker because she broke into the Three Bears' home uninvited, and then she became a squatter. Now, isn't that what happened? So she breaks in and then she's trying out their food and their chairs and their beds, and Papa Bear's is, you know, his is too big and too heavy and too uncomfortable, and Mama's is too soft, and Baby Bear's is just right. Okay, so then the bears come and she flees. Now, if that was in California today, because she broke in while they were away, then she would have a legal right to stay there, and the bears couldn't put her out. Okay, I digress. But so these scientists actually talk about, and they use this term, a Goldilocks planet, meaning it's got exactly the right elements and the right quantities all together. It's just right. And in this case, we're talking about just right to support human life. Now, they think about it in terms of supporting other life, and they keep all these searches, man. Are they intent on trying to find life existing somewhere other than this planet? Good luck. I really don't believe they're going to do it. There's a lot of elements on other planets. I'm going to try and briefly cover some of that. But nothing brings it all together to create the kind of habitat that it takes to actually have living, thriving beings like this particular planet does. So they say the NASA's Kepler mission is helping in the quest for Goldilocks planets where conditions are just right for the development of life. There is only one planet we know of, they say, so far, that is drenched with life. And I like the wording. Jet Propulsion Laboratory uses a lot more creative wording than the dull NASA stuff. But they said there's only one planet we know of so far that is drenched with life. That planet is Earth, as you may have guessed, and it has all the right conditions for critters to thrive on its surface. Do other planets, they say, beyond our solar system called exoplanets also host life forms? Astronomers still don't know the answer, but they search for potentially habitable planets using a handful of criteria. Ideally, they say, they want to find planets just like Earth, since we know without a doubt that life took root here. Now, obviously, these are all, you know, ones who believe in evolution and on all this nonsense. So their wording is going to be couched in that. But what they acknowledge, and they have to, is that this is a planet teeming with life. Unlike every other, you know, planet or rock or star that's out there in the universe that they can detect. So they say the hunt is on for planets about the size of Earth that orbit at just the right distance from their star in a region termed the habitable zone. NASA's Kepler mission, they say, is helping scientists in the quest to find these worlds, sometimes called Goldilocks planets after the fairy tale because they orbit where conditions are just right for life. Kepler and other telescopes have confirmed a handful so far, all of which are a bit larger than Earth, called the super-Earths. The search for Earth's twin, meaning a habitable zone planet as small as Earth, is ongoing. And why do they want one the same size as Earth? That gets into all the issues about gravity and the effects of the atmosphere. And because if you have a larger planet, guess what happens? It has more gravity, which means it pushes down on you. Which means even if they found a planet that had all these things, even air to breathe or whatever, the extra pressure would actually make it hard for us to move and to function, as if you weighed two or three times as much as your current body weight. So they want to find another planet just like Earth, because it would include all of those factors that we take for granted in order for people to live and to thrive. Going on, it says, the search for Earth's twin, a habitable zone planet as small as Earth, is ongoing. An important part of this research is the continuing investigation into exactly where a star's habitable zone starts and stops. So they're using their telescopes to look outside of our solar system to try to find other stars that happen to have detectable planets orbiting around those stars, and not too close and not too far away, but just right, so that they might have a climate and the size of the planet and everything happening that could support life like ours does. They haven't even come close. They finally, I think it was only a few years ago, where they literally were able to find another star outside of our solar system with their telescopes and their other detection devices that even has a planet orbiting. You think that's all, well, surely, well, because Star Trek and all that shows us, you know, there's all these other worlds. Well, within the reach of human beings, it is very, very hard to find proof of another star that even has a planet going around it. They have found some. But then, what are they like? They're not habitable at all. But they keep looking. Carrying on this quotation, it says, the habitable zone is the belt around a star where temperatures are ideal for liquid water. I bet you didn't know liquid water is the big thing. Because there are other planets in our solar system that actually have water. If you think Earth is the only one that has water, you'd be wrong. Our moon, by the way, has water in the form of ice on the north and the south poles of the moon, where it never gets enough of the light of the sun in order to melt. Because you know what would happen on the moon if the ice melted? Because our moon has no atmosphere. Then that liquid water would just basically disappear off the surface. So there's a lot of factors that are required in order for a planet actually to have not just water, but liquid water. There's water on Mars. There's water on probably one of the moons of Jupiter, Europa. There's water out there, but it's not in a configuration that can be usable, let alone support life. So it says the habitable zone is the belt around a star where temperatures are ideal for liquid water, an essential ingredient for life as we know it, to pool on a planet's surface. Earth lies within the habitable zone of our star called the sun. Beyond this zone, a planet would probably be too cold and frozen for life, though it's possible life could be buried underneath a moon's surface, again, which is what they think about Europa. A planet, they say, lying between a star and the habitable zone would likely be too hot and steamy. That perfect Goldilocks planet within the zone wouldn't necessarily be home to any furry creatures, but it would have the potential for some type of life to abound, even if it were microbes. So this is their hope. They want to find life, even if it's, you know, some little amoeba or something that can live. You know, we on the Earth, there's all kinds of life that lives in areas on this globe which would not support human life, like at the bottom of the ocean near some of these volcanic vents, where you've got lava coming up on the seabed a long, long way down, and they've found little living creatures that actually live right near the vents where this volcanic activity happens at the bottom of the sea. So they would love to find that kind of life somewhere else. So far, no evidence of it. So let me ask you this question, because this is going to point us toward the end of this sermon when I'm talking about the prophecy from the book of Revelation. What would happen if the Earth moved out of its current orbit around the sun where it is right now? Either it moved in closer to the sun or else it moved farther away from the sun. Do you know what happened? It would totally upset the environment that you're used to on this Earth. And it's going to become important prophetically, because God said he's going to start messing with things in the solar system and in the heavens. But back now, I'm going to use some citations from another website. It's a NASA website, but it's specifically the Goddard Space Flight Center. I'm trying to keep it simple and condensed. And so actually, if you want to go out there, the NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center website has a section called an article, Is Anyone Home? In other words, it's about this quest for life somewhere other than the Earth. Is anyone home? And it summarizes a lot of these details of what it takes in order to find a habitat where life, not just human life, but other forms of life, something living, could actually be sustained, let alone human beings. They call it your guide to exoplanet habitability, meaning somewhere away from Earth that has all the necessary ingredients for life, they say, as we know it. All right, so now, and this is actually on the website, they have some good illustrations and graphics. And they make it really, really simple. And what I'm doing is kind of summarizing just some of the words and the statements, the summaries that go with the graphics. It's a lot more effective if you care to take a look at that yourself. But the first graphic is entitled Stars. So now we're looking at all the elements that would make any planet or any orb potentially a habitation for living creatures, especially human beings. What are all the ingredients in particular that you need? Well, you got to have a star, which is a source of your energy. So that, and they divide this up in the activity and the attributes of different stars. We take our sun for granted. But what is it that makes our planet able to survive and to thrive, and us on this planet? There are attributes of our sun that we should not take for granted. Number one, activity. Okay, what's the activity? Stars, they say, release UV light, X-rays, and energetic particles, all of which can be harmful to life and strip away a planet's atmosphere. So, in other words, a star can kill a planet, or the things that could make a planet a habitation for living creatures, and a star can absolutely kill it. Why does that not happen with ours? They say some stars are more active than others. And what's one of the factors that affect that? The age of the star. Now, I guess they have their methods for trying to figure out how old a star is. They say old stars expand quickly, engulfing nearby planets. So they're talking about a lifespan of a star from the time it first forms until however many, you know, eons that it exists. And ultimately, every star has a lifespan. I don't remember what they say. They estimate what they think our sun has, but it's a few million years, they think, before it literally turns into this giant and then consumes everything in our solar system and destroys it. But supposedly that's going to happen. And I wouldn't doubt it. Remember, God created all of this for the purpose of executing this plan on this earth and for human beings. So it only has to exist for the time that it takes in order to accomplish that plan, and then God's going to burn the whole thing up anyway. So no, that sun is not going to exist for a few million years like the scientists think. In short order, God's going to destroy it. He was the one that brought it into being, and he's the one that's going to take it out, regardless of what the scientists think about it. But they talk about the age of a star, an old star versus a new star. An old star becomes threatening because it starts to expand and then ultimately consumes everything around it. And then they say turns into a black hole. So a dead star, the end of a star's life, ultimately ends in a black hole, at least in some cases. All right, so that's the age. What about the size and the type of stars? They say some stars may be good for life, others may just be too extreme. These stellar factors determine whether a habitable planet might be found and if life could survive there at all. Planets, they say, around large stars have to be far from their star and may not have enough time to develop life before the star dies. Meaning if it's a large star, it's an old star, it's maybe ticking down on its existence before it destroys everything in its reach. Planets, they say, around small stars, meaning newer stars, must be very close to their volatile hosts. Any life could be fried by stellar activity. So that's the problem. If it's a small star, then in order to be in a habitable zone, you got to be closer. But a small star is unpredictable and very volatile and might kill everything. So the point is, our sun, as a star, which it is just right. Because it provides everything we need, the amount of light and the amount of heat, but not too much and not too radical. It's not too little and it's not too much. Now, just recently, it's amazing, within the last 2 weeks, we had all of this stellar activity from our sun, and this goes in an 11-year cycle, so I read. And we're kind of at the height of a time in this 11-year cycle for sun activity, with all of these solar flares. They call them CMEs, coronal mass ejections, where all these flares start to happen, and all of that energy translates in all directions, including ours, and affects our Earth. It causes disruptions and also the northern lights. So some of you may, we tried to see it here in Oregon. I couldn't see it from Eugene. Some of you, under the hearing of my voice, probably were able to see the northern lights, even in latitudes that usually don't allow it, because of the unusual solar activity. But that's because you have these upheavals going on the surface of the sun, which now radiate out. And it's got all this dangerous stuff. So why didn't we get destroyed? Because this planet has protections, including a magnetic field. We'll talk about that. But this Goddard Flight Center quotation says, planets around small stars must be very close to their volatile host. Any life could be fried by stellar activity. So it's very volatile. Now let's go to the Bible, Psalm 84. Psalm 84, verses 11 and 12. Because God compares himself to this star in our solar system called the sun. So God obviously made all of these things, and they all picture things symbolically in the spiritual realm that he wants us to understand, because it's recorded here in the Bible. And here's one of them, Psalm 84, verse 11. For the eternal God is a sun and a shield. So that's interesting. Because I don't put that together automatically. He's a son. Well, and this isn't S-O-N. This isn't talking about Jesus Christ as a son, as a child of the Father. It's a son, S-U-N. And so God says the eternal God is a son and a shield. The eternal will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. O eternal of hosts, blessed is the man that trusts in thee. So in other words, what God is saying is, I'm not one of those dangerous, volatile stars that's likely to kill you. In other words, he's saying, I'm a good star. I'm a good star. I'm actually a help to sustain life, not to eradicate life. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 6. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 6. For God, who commanded the light, where does the light come from? The sun. Physically, our light comes from the sun. God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, hath shined in our hearts. So now he's making this direct comparison between physical light that we get from the sun to make life possible on this planet and comparing that now to something that happens spiritually in his dealing with every one of his children. God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, hath shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. So here, sunlight upon this earth is compared to the presence of Jesus Christ as an energy source in order to provide and to sustain life spiritually. Isn't that interesting? Malachi 4, verse 2. Malachi 4, verse 2, but unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness. And again, this isn't son, S-O-N. But it is capital, S-U-N. It is speaking about that star that we call our sun, and God making a comparison of Jesus Christ again to a star. Unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. So it would be inappropriate to describe the sun's influence in this physical solar system as having healing. And yet, what are the properties of sunlight? Aren't they incredibly helpful to human beings? Yes. Now, too much, and you know it's damaging, right? Have you ever had a sunburn? So it has to be taken in moderation, and yet how many of us could live without the sunlight? Absolutely no life would exist without the rays of the sun on the surface of this earth. But it then has to be in right measure in order to keep from killing us all. It has to be just right. And so here it's described. Unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings, and you shall go forth and grow up as calves in the stall. You become blessed people. Physically, because of being in an environment that allows you to survive and to thrive. Spiritually, because again, Jesus Christ, who's compared to this star, is providing a light of his way of life, which leads to eternity for those who complete that process. And Habakkuk 3, Habakkuk 3, verses 3 and 4. Here we read, God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran, Selah. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. So he's setting the stage poetically now again to describe and to use these physical elements that we know in our solar system to describe something spiritual that's going on. His glory covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. Verse 4, and his brightness was as the light, meaning the light of the sun. So God compares his glory, the glory of his personage, as the same effect of our sun in the middle of our solar system, which provides light to the earth and all of the planets. His brightness was as the light, meaning the sun. He had horns, and that's not, in the English, it's not horns. This is a word in the Hebrew that actually means rays. We're talking about rays of the sun. He had rays coming out of his hand, and there was the hiding of his power. So we're talking about a force of energy that is the center, that provides the ability for life to exist and to thrive. And it's compared to the sun, but then he also speaks about what happens if that light is covered. And is there and will there be a covering of that light source, that energy source? Yes. We'll talk about that later. What we find is that the activity of the sun has a huge impact upon this earth. And also, of course, for good and for evil, depending upon how it interrelates with the activities of the earth and other planets. All right, so from that Goddard Space Flight Center website, again, I'm using this article entitled, Is Anyone Home? And they're listing in a succinct fashion all of the different elements that are required in order to try and find a place where life can exist, let alone to thrive. And so the first one is about the star. So we've talked about the need for an energy source and a star. And that's the center. All right, what else do you need? Well, you need planets, right? Our solar system has planets. And the first element, and there are several elements with planets that are important. The first is orbits. Orbits, of course, is the movement of a planet around its star, around and around and around. And in our solar system, we have multiple planets, and they all have their own orbits around the sun. But in orbits in general, here's what they say. How and where a planet orbits its star is very important for its habitability. Planets in eccentric orbits, or those experiencing dramatic change in tilt, could have extreme seasons. Now, the Earth, by the way, has a tilt, meaning it spins on an axis as it orbits the sun. And because of that tilt, about 23 degrees, what's the effect upon the Earth? We have seasons, experienced in different ways depending on what part of the globe you're on, from northern latitudes to southern latitudes or near the equator. But we have seasons on this planet because of the tilt. Other planets in our solar system also have a tilt, or some of them have very little, and it affects whether they have seasons or whether they don't. So this is just speaking about the obvious, things that we take for granted, but affect a lot. They say habitable planets are likely found in the Goldilocks zone. Everybody uses this term, meaning they're just the right distance from their star for liquid water to exist on the surface. We go back to liquid water again. Isn't it amazing? Planets, they say, which orbit too closely to each other. Now we're not talking about a planet that's too close to its star. We're talking about a system that might have planets that orbit a star, but they then are also too close to each other. Planets which orbit too closely to each other can affect the stability of each other's orbits and climates. I bet you never thought about that. One of the things that makes this Earth a good place to live is the fact that we don't have other planets getting in our way. Because what if there was another one that was close enough and had a strong enough gravity or magnetism so that even if it was every few hundred years, we got too close to each other as we're both going around the sun, and our environment was upset because of the movement of this other planet? That would make life on this planet a lot less inhospitable and maybe even cause extinction. So if you think it's just about a planet going around the sun, no, it's also about other things going around. All right, that's orbits. What about magnetic fields? They say on Earth, magnetic fields are produced by a spinning molten iron core You say, well, how do they know that? I don't know what all the evidence is, but I believe it, by the way, that there is a molten iron core. I would say I believe it because there are magnetic fields around this earth. So we are like, this earth is like a motor. It's like an electric motor with electrical properties, with huge magnetic fields which surround the earth. In order for that to true physically, there has to be something that's providing the magnetism. It's in the center of the earth. So they say magnetic fields are produced by a spinning molten iron core on this earth. The field protects the planet's atmosphere from harmful activity from its star, which could impact the habitability of some forms of life. So you may not think about it, but the fact that there's this big, it's like having a force field around the earth. This magnetic field actually shields us from harmful rays from the sun. So the sun's spitting off all kinds of rays. Some are good for us and some are bad for us. The magnetic field around the earth actually reflects off or siphons off a lot of bad particles that could destroy life on this earth. Would we survive on this earth if there was not a magnetic field around us? And the answer would be no. And by the way, you cannot believe both in a flat earth and also in the Van Allen radiation belt. The flat earthers then don't believe, in essence, that this is an orb, a sphere with a molten core creating magnetic fields, and yet the magnetic fields above the surface of the earth are real. Now, the others that don't think we went to the moon, because one of their arguments is, well, human beings cannot pass through the Van Allen belts without being fried. So God made it so that, in other words, he put a physical limit so that human beings can't pass through it. So the claim that they took a rocket ship through the Van Allen belt and went to the moon is bogus. So you've got all these that will say that, and they're wrong. And the scientist Van Allen, by the way, who studied and documented it, is the one who also said, oh, no, human beings can go through it. And they do. Now, I think any of these astronauts that go up there and pass through it are definitely probably limiting their lifespan because they are subjecting themselves to additional radiation. But all the experts know about that radiation and are working to mitigate it. But it's one of the things they have to work on. So human beings want to escape their habitat, the one that God gave them and commanded them to stay upon. And one of the threats to their survival is the fact that they don't have that magnetic field around the earth to protect them. So now they have to create an artificial habitat in order to do the same thing that the magnetic field does to protect us. One of the many complications that happens when man gets outside of his appointed home. All right, what else? Orbits, magnetic fields, how about the size of a planet? I referenced it earlier because I couldn't help myself. But here, they say the size of a planet plays a large role in how much atmosphere it can hold. Planets that are too large hide their surfaces under atmospheres much thicker than Earth's. So I mentioned that. You have a larger planet, and it has, and its atmosphere is actually more dense because of gravity, because of this mass of the planet. And a human being, you're not designed to breathe air that's too thick. Even if it was the right composition of air, it's got to be the right density. I talked about some of that when we talked about air. Your atmosphere can't be too thin, but it also can't be too thick. And on a larger planet than the Earth, you'd have, even if you had everything else, like a magnetic field, your atmosphere would be too thick in order for you to comfortably breathe or to be able to breathe at all. Which is why, again, they're looking for other planets to try and find life that are approximately the size of Earth, because it's perfect. The mass of the Earth is perfect according to the laws of physics to create an atmosphere in which you can live. They also say small planets can't keep their star's stellar winds from blowing away their atmospheres. That's a problem with a small star or a small planet. There's not enough gravity in order to keep its atmosphere. And then this activity from the sun basically peels away the atmosphere and leaves it with no atmosphere at all. Our moon is that way, by the way. There is no atmosphere on our moon. Okay, another category they call is composition. Composition, they say, is important for a habitat. What do they mean by that? They say a planet must include the elements needed for life. Water, especially liquid water, is considered the key component of life. Too much of them could disrupt the planet's chemistry, climate, or plate tectonics. Radioactive elements help drive life-supporting processes like plate tectonics and magnetic field formation, blah, 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 I know. But these are all elements that are real when it comes to the physicality of an orb and whether it can sustain life. Let's look at Isaiah 42, verse 5. God doesn't give us details scientifically. But if you understand certain details scientifically, and he has allowed man to accumulate knowledge. It is one of the prophecies for the last days that knowledge would increase, he said in Daniel. So human beings have a lot of mixture of truth and error. They have a lot of mistakes in what they think is true. But they have amassed a lot of knowledge which is real. Isaiah 42, verse 5, thus saith God the Eternal, he that created the heavens and stretched them out, he that spreads forth the earth and that which cometh out of it. So what comes out of the earth? We talked about minerals. All of this movement of water on the earth, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, all of these physical things which happen upon this earth actually are involved in positive processes that actually provide minerals and things that man uses, without which it would be a different life upon this earth, no doubt about it. He that spreads forth the earth and that which comes out of it, he that giveth breath unto the people upon it, and spirit to them that walk therein. Human beings are blessed upon this planet because of all these physical properties that God made. Many of them we don't even know or realize, and yet they're real and they're true. The scientists understand a lot of them. Now, stopping right there, how different is the Earth from the other planets in our solar system? How many planets are there? Anybody know? Well, depends on whether you're talking about their definition of a planet today or 20 years ago. 20 years ago, they said there were 9 planets. I grew up learning that there were 9 planets, including Pluto. Now they say Pluto's not a planet. They've redefined it, and they say there's only 8. I still go with 9, because like today they say Pluto is not a planet. They call it a dwarf planet, different category, and say there's at least 3 or 4 other dwarf planets in our solar system besides Pluto, but it's stepchild, second-class citizen. They say 8. What's the nearest planet to the sun? Mercury. So you know Mercury's hot. It's not a habitation for man, right? Second planet out from Mercury in orbit around our sun is Venus. Venus is the brightest one, by the way, that you can see in the night sky very often. It's very often the brightest object you will see in the sky will be the planet Venus. So that's not a star. If you look up and you see and you think you're looking at a star, technically you're looking at a planet when you see Venus. Venus happens to be the hottest planet. Even though it's second, it's Mercury is closer and you think, well, the side of Mercury that faces the sun is boiling hot, hundreds of degrees in temperature. But the problem is Mercury actually revolves on its axis very slowly, which means it's actually got a dark side to Venus away from the sun, which is super cold. So the fact that that planet does not actually revolve quickly also affects temperature. It's hundreds of degrees hot on one side and hundreds of degrees below zero on the other side, even though it's the closest planet to the Earth. Fun fact. Venus is actually the hottest, because it actually spins faster, which means the entire planet gets exposed to the sun's rays. And it is so hot, it's like 800 plus degrees Fahrenheit with a toxic environment of gases on its surface. Which one comes next, Venus Venus and then what? Or Mercury, Venus, and then what? The Earth. That's why they call us the third rock from the sun. And by the way, we're talking about terrestrial planets, ones that are solid, have a surface. It includes Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, which is the fourth planet out. Beyond that, you've got ones that they consider, the next four are considered gas giants because they don't have solid surfaces. That's Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. All right, so they don't have a solid surface. If you were in a spaceship that could go there, you couldn't land anywhere because you'd be in a sea of gas. Like on Jupiter, it's basically condensed, I think, a hydrogen and helium in a liquid form because it is so hot and so much pressure on that planet. So it's not even got a physical surface. They call them gas giants. Mars is the one that is nearest in properties to the Earth, which is why human beings seem to have this fascination and want to go there, maybe even build a colony there. Not going to happen, but that's their aspiration. Mars has one-third of the gravity of Earth. It actually has a day about the same as ours, almost about a 24-hour day, and a tilt that's very similar to ours. So there's a lot of properties that make Mars a potential for being a habitation for life, which is why they keep sending probes there looking for life. There's evidence that there used to be liquid water. There's ice there, but there's no liquid water there because it's too cold. But there's geology on there they found, which makes them think that at one time it might have had an atmosphere and it might have had liquid water. Who knows? I don't believe there was life there, however. So, what's another property? I want to talk about Jupiter. Why talk about Jupiter? Jupiter is the largest planet in our solar system. It's like the big brother that protects us. Did you realize that? How big is Jupiter? If the Earth is the size of a grape, Jupiter would be the size of a basketball. It's got gravity and it's got a magnetic field around it, which dwarfs that of the Earth. Jupiter as a planet has this huge magnetic field, which affects everything, including us. And you know what one of the properties that Jupiter provides? It protects us from asteroids on the Earth. That's why I wanted to get to this. The movement of Jupiter, actually, if something foreign, a comet or some other thing, comes into our solar system with the threat of impacting the Earth, Jupiter is one of the sentinels of the guards in our solar system that either deflects it off or else sucks it in. Now, it can happen, you know, they think that there have been times when then the movement and slingshot effects around Jupiter have actually caused impacts on the Earth. But for the present time, there's this huge asteroid belt in between Mars and Jupiter because of the magnetic field of Jupiter, which keeps all this debris out there and away from us. So here's another element. What would happen if we didn't have Jupiter? It is very likely that even if you had every other element needed to make a habitable planet, which we have, it would constantly be at threat from meteorites and foreign objects. And because you have Jupiter out there, we have a certain amount of protection. Not total. But right now, that's what the scientists think. It's actually doing us a favor. What happens if God starts messing with Jupiter? You think it might come into play in the future? I think so. This Goddard Space Flight website now talks about another requirement, which you know, which is climate or atmosphere. Temperate climate. To keep oceans of liquid water, a planet requires a temperate climate. This means an atmosphere that supplies the right amount of global warming. Oh, global warming's not bad? No, global warming's actually good. They didn't say that, I said that. Water, carbon dioxide, methane, clouds, and particles all can impact surface temperature. Detecting gases that are made by life is one way we could confirm a planet's habitability, meaning if life exists, they might be able to prove it by other things that they see in the atmosphere. Good luck. Isaiah 40, verse 21. Isaiah 40, verse 21. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? Meaning when all these things first came into being by the direction of God. It is he that sits upon the circle of the earth. So the flat earthers say that means a flat circle, not a sphere. What nonsense. He that sits upon the circle of the earth and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretches out the heavens as a curtain and spreads them out as a tent to dwell in. So here's the poetic imagery that describes, when you apply to what we know scientifically about the existence of our solar system and the position of all the planets as they're all going around the sun, it's like a ballet. And they all have their role and they all have their part. I bet there's a lot of it that the scientists have not even begun to discover or to understand, but that are real. And this massive clock, if you will, that works in perfect harmony for the purpose of making this little planet that you and I live on a perfect habitat to support life. So it's not just about them looking for another star that has a planet going around that's in a Goldilocks zone that might have the right temperature and it has a magnetic field and it has liquid water where life might exist, but it better have all these other protections against asteroids and against the movements of other bodies in that solar system as well. Otherwise, you would still have an extinction of life if it ever existed. Again, I remind you from the beginning of this, I'm trying to convince you of how vulnerable we are. Life on this planet is always hanging by a thread, even though it seems to be so robust. And you take it for granted because it's always been. And by nature, you think it will be there for the rest of your lifetime, and maybe it will. But this is a delicate balance of properties that are required all to work in perfect harmony. Otherwise, everything dies. What else? What else besides a proper star, planets in their proper position, atmosphere? We've already talked about water, but here's an expansion on water, like ice caps. Here they say, as on Earth, ice caps help regulate the climate of a planet by reflecting energy from its star. The larger the ice caps, the colder the atmosphere, meaning more ice can form, like an icebox effect. If the caps become too large, they can lead to an extreme ice age. In response, the planet will accumulate greenhouse gases, heat up, and melt the ice. And that, there's geological evidence for supposedly, you know, this change. More ice at certain times on this earth, less ice at other times, and this back and forth. Amos 9, verse 6. Amos 9, verse 6 says, it is he that buildeth his stories in the heaven. What are these stories or levels? I can't tell you, but it's a it's symbolism that speaks literally about the building of God, as if this solar system and everything that exists is a building project. It certainly was constructed with purpose. It is he that buildeth his stories in the heavens and hath founded his troop in the earth. I didn't do a word study to analyze what all this might mean. You can do that. He that calleth for the waters of the sea and poureth them out upon the face of the earth. The Lord is his name. So scientists identify liquid water is a big, big, big thing if you want to find life. Here's just one of many statements in the Bible where God says he's the one that put water on the earth. Don't take it for granted. What else? Icy ocean worlds, they say. Like Jupiter's moon Europa, I've mentioned that one, exoplanets may have vast oceans hidden beneath thick layers of ice. They don't know that for certain, but they think Europa. one of the moons around Jupiter actually may be ice covered with lots of water underneath. They intend to send probes. They've got a new one coming up here probably this year called Europa Clipper. It's just going to go out there and circle around, take pictures, and try to do some studies. They keep trying to learn more. But they think they might find life, because if there's water, even if it's cold, cold, cold water under this icy crust, maybe there's life. They're grasping at straws. They say it's possible that life thrives in these oceans if tidal heating and radioactivity keep them warm. I mean, it's got to be warm enough. So they just hope, hope, hope. They say oceans are important. Water is essential for life as we know it because it acts as a solvent for organic chemistry, foundation of life on Earth. Deep oceans can protect early life, you know, evolutionary ideas, can protect early life from an active star. They also help stabilize the climate and transport energy across its surface. Tides. You probably don't realize, yes, you probably know that the tide, the movement of tides in our oceans has to do with the moon going around us. They claim the tides are actually important for us. It's not incidental, but necessary. They say tides on Earth are powered by the moon and the sun. They help stabilize the orbit and tilt of the planet, as well as slow the spin rate. So the moon, what they're claiming is that the moon actually going around and around our Earth is also a key ingredient to regulating the speed of the Earth's rotation on its axis and the movement of the oceans, the tide in and tide out, twice a day, every day, is a part of the governor or the regulator, if you will, on this whole physical process. That's interesting. So what happens if we didn't have a moon? In other words, they're claiming if we didn't have a moon going around the Earth, it would change a lot of the properties. They say if the tidal force is too strong, the planet could experience tidal locking, which would dramatically alter the planet's climate. Tides help warm oceans circulate nutrients all over the planet, move currents, and influence plate tectonics. Bet you didn't even realize that. Then they talk about hydrothermal vents, one of those deep volcanoes at the bottom of the oceans. They say these vents are like deep sea mini volcanoes that create nutrient-rich hot water, which has its application for sustaining our planet. Then they have a whole separate section called surface, carbon cycle feedback, plate tectonics, and volcanism. I'm not going to read all of that. But all factors, they're saying, that are important to creating a livable habitat for life as we know it. So all of this movement of the plates on the Earth, even though volcanoes are dangerous, they can kill human beings, and yet volcanic activity is a necessary part of maintaining the attributes of this planet, which is good for life. Psalm 97, verse 4. Psalm 97, verse 4 says, "His lightnings enlightened the world. The earth saw and trembled." So poetically, we're talking about the earth being a witness to or involved with these electromagnetic events like lightning that take place in our atmosphere. Verse 5, "The hills melted like wax at the presence of the Eternal." Is that a reference maybe to volcanic activity with molten lava that comes up because of the movement of these tectonic plates? And then it forms. It's where a lot of the islands originated, supposedly. Volcanic activity out in the middle of the ocean that actually turns into dry land. "The hills melted like wax at the presence of the Eternal, at the presence of the Lord of the whole earth. The heavens declare his righteousness and all the people see his glory." I would tell you that one of the good positive advantages of human scientific advancement is a greater understanding and appreciation for the physical properties that God made that people of antiquity maybe didn't know The more they learn, the more they should come to appreciate the necessity for a creator that saw all this in motion. It wasn't a happy accident. It's too complex. It's too interrelated. It's too dependent upon these multiple factors in order to make any of it exist. There has to be a God. There has to be a purposeful God who is actually keeping that all together according to His will. The last category they say on this Goddard Space Flight Center website is interior, like the core of the Earth. They say a liquid iron core is important for protecting life on a planet's surface. I didn't know that. They say the movement of molten iron generates a magnetic field which shields the atmosphere from stellar activity. We did talk about that. Some planets with iron cores, like Earth, start with a completely liquid core which crystallizes over time. For planets with small cores, the core may completely solidify, turning off the magnetic field, and I think that's the case with Mars. Supposedly, there's geologic evidence that Mars used to have a magnetic field around it, and now it does not. It does have an atmosphere. Mars has an atmosphere, but it's a weak atmosphere. So again, the magnet in the middle of the planet creates a magnetic field like a force field around it to protect it from negative solar activity, which protects the atmosphere inside and keeps the atmosphere from just flitting away into the universe. And that happens when you've got a structure like we have on this planet. All right, what are some of those last day prophecies concerning upheaval upon this earth? You read them, I bet you've never looked at them from the standpoint of science. Matthew 24, verse 29. Matthew 24, verse 29, immediately, this is Christ now speaking a prophecy for what's going to happen just before his second coming. Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, because the moon reflects the light of the sun. If the sun is darkened, the moon's going to be darkened. The sun shall be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. I don't know physically what God's going to do, but He can push the levers any way He wants to make all of this happen. I would just tell you, one of the things physically He could do is to get rid or move Jupiter out of the way. And then Big Brother is gone. Now, God can just send meteor, you know, stars falling as it's described from our vantage point on the earth. We don't know what they are. It's not other suns necessarily. We call anything we see in the sky a star. Meteors, comets, whatever else, there's incredible geological history to show impacts upon this earth, and probably that was used actually during the rebellion of Satan to destroy this earth. But what God is describing here prophetically is a time when these things are going to start happening again and absolutely threaten the stability of this planet as a habitat for man and put us all in danger of death. When you start having meteor strikes, huge meteor strikes that upset the atmosphere, which is what happens when you have a very, very large strike, it is going to get the attention of human beings, which is the point. And the powers of heaven shall be shaken. All these things which are predictably in their place, God is going to move out of their place. He's going to upset the habitat upon this earth by virtue of changing things in the solar system. And then, verse 30, shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. It's a precursor to His triumphant arrival to take possession of this earth and to rule. And so this is referred to in the book of Revelation as the sixth seal, the upheaval of the heavenly bodies. Luke 21, verse 10. Luke 21, verse 10. Then said He unto them, nation shall rise against nation, and kingdoms against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in divers places. Now, we've always had earthquakes. And every time there's another earthquake somewhere up on the earth, people in the church like to say, oh, I wonder if this is the prophesied fulfillment. No. Why? Because there have always been earthquakes, some incredibly devastating. But we're talking about a time to come when earthquakes are going to be different than they've ever been, more frequent and more devastating. We haven't seen that. When you see that happen, one of the ways you know it's different is when you see human beings change their minds. I'm not saying come to God, but when they start getting scared, when they start wondering what's going on. Up to now, they're able to justify everything geologically as being a part of a natural cycle. Or maybe they claim it on human, you know, climate change or whatever. Nevertheless, it's natural. We're talking about a time when it's going to become unnatural. And that's what Christ said is going to happen. And fearful, and the great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines and pestilence, and fearful sights, and great signs shall there be from heaven. Meaning the things are going to be moving around up there. They're not where they're supposed to be. Revelation 6, verse 12. Final text. Revelation 6, verse 12. And I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal. Here it is. And lo, there was a great earthquake. This is going to be unusual. There was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair. What is going to make the sun go dark from our vantage point on the earth? It's going to be one of those times, in essence, where God, we saw that text in Isaiah with the rays, in essence, coming out of his hand, because he's the source of light and energy, and yet he's going to darken it. I don't know how physically he can do it in many, many different ways. But our sun is going to be dimmed in its intensity, and I guarantee you it's going to throw everything physically upon the surface of this earth into upheaval. We need the sun as it radiates at its current intensity. We don't want too much, but we don't want too little. Here's describing a time when the sun is going to be dimmed, and human beings are going to be scared to death. There's also other, and I'm not taking the time to turn to it, where it says the sun is going to get so hot it's going to scorch men on the earth. How is he going to do that? Perhaps remove part of the magnetic field around the earth, increase the intensity of the star, a lot of different ways. He's got a lot of levers that he can throw in order to make these things happen. And the stars of heaven fell unto the earth, verse 13. Let me finish verse 12. And the moon became as blood, again, because of the effect of the sun, the moon, and the light from the moon upon the earth is automatically affected. And the stars fell, the stars of heaven fell unto the earth. A lot of meteor strikes are going to be happening. Even as a fig tree casts her untimely figs when she is shaken of a mighty wind, and the heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together. I can't get an image of what that's like. The heaven departed as a scroll when it is rolled together. Somehow the things of being able to look up in the sky and see things, and that's going to change and be affected. And every mountain and island were moved out of their places. That's what this earthquake's going to do. What's going to cause it? I don't know. God's in charge of it. My point, and again, if I've accomplished anything, it's to make you feel that the earth upon which you live and very often take for granted is very vulnerable. You live on a planet that is not here by accident. It was set as a habitat for human life as well as animal life. And it is incredibly fragile. And the day is coming when, for purpose to get the attention of arrogant human beings and to humble them in preparation for his appearance in the heavens, is going to send all of this into chaos. And I guarantee you that is going to scare human beings to death. Everything they take for granted is going to be thrown into question. If you understand even a modicum of the science behind the way it works now, hopefully it gives us an appreciation for the incredible habitat that we have upon this earth.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the eighth message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled Habitat for God and Man, given in Eugene, Oregon, May 18th, 2024.